From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, who wants what in the long war over taxes in Michigan?
We don't often get open and honest discussions about taxes from politicians because it's risky business if you want to stay in office.
State business climate rankings are rising, but what does that really mean?
What's good for business isn't always good for the general economy.
It's one of the most enduring radio formats, classic rock, going strong after 30 years.
Just all of those memories that you have as a teen, that stuff is really near and dear to you, and that's what formats are made of.
And that format began right here in Michigan.
That older legacy, heritage, nostalgia music was pretty much being ignored on the radio.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. More than $50 billion. That's how much Lansing will spend this year. But how to get everyone to agree on how to spend? That's where things get interesting. I'm Cynthia Canty. The fight over taxing and spending today on Stateside. But first, Michigan's Freedom of Information Act regulates the disclosure of public records by all public bodies in the state. Or so says the state attorney general's office in a pamphlet that explains the law. But just a few lines down on that pamphlet is something that many citizens might not be aware of. The public body does not include the governor's office or the lieutenant governor and their employees. Reporter Paul Egan looked at Michigan's public records law for the Detroit Free Press. Paul, how many states allow the governor's office to be exempt from FOIA requests?
Only two give a blanket exemption, sending Michigan and Massachusetts as the other. Louisiana also did until a few years ago, but the present governor removed that blanket exemption.
And as you noted in your piece for the Free Press, the White House is also exempt from the federal FOIA.
That's right. Executives do get different treatment in many of these laws as people that need to be able to get sort of unrestricted advice. The candor argument is one that's often made. The argument is that they need their aides to be able to talk to them without, including, I guess, through written reports, without having to feel intimidated that this information might become public.
And I gather, is that something Governor Snyder has pointed out when he talks about this?
Yeah, it's the main thing he points out when he's asked about it. He said, I want my advisors to be able to speak frankly and when we're brainstorming and kicking around ideas. Of course, you know, anything like that would only be captured if a written record or a recording was made of it. But the other thing that, about Michigan's FOIA law is it already has a restriction that would cover something like that. There's an existing exemption for communications of an advisory nature, and many state departments already use that to cover things like draft reports that they'll sometimes not want to release because they say, well, this was still advisory, it wasn't final. So, you know, it would seem that the governor's office could be covered and governors would still have the ability to get advisory opinions that they could keep secret.
I'm talking with Paul Egan with the Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau, whose front page story in Sunday's Free Press looked into Michigan's public records law and the fact that the governor, lieutenant governor, and our state lawmakers appear to be exempt from Michigan's Freedom of Information Act. What got you digging into this story, Paul, in the first place?
Well, it's something that's interested me for a long time, and also really this is just one of several issues that we run into with the Freedom of Information Act at the Free Press because we do use it quite a bit, and there's other issues like fees that are charged and time that it takes to get a response that really aren't the subject to this article. But where this came up, really, we've been following the Aramark story pretty closely, and back in August, the governor announced that he was going to move monitoring of the contract into his office, and we had actually just finished publishing a pretty extensive report on problems with the contract, and we had based that report largely on records that we'd obtained through the Department of Corrections under the FOIA law. So we were wondering, as many others were, whether the plan was to move it into the governor's office so that these records would no longer be made public. And the governor's office denied that, and they actually ended up moving the new monitor into one of the state agencies that is covered by FOIA. So that was, I guess, a false alarm, you could call it. But it still did sort of raise the issue, and we thought it was probably a good time to let people know what is covered and what isn't covered in terms of state offices under the FOIA law.
I have to wonder, after reading your piece, Paul, how much does it really matter to have the governor covered by FOIA? Because you found out, for example, you talked to someone in Florida that kind of spelled ways that they can get around it.
Yeah, that's a great question, because you know, Florida actually has it right in their state constitution that they're entitled to public records, and they're considered, you know, one of the great sunshine states, and not just because it's so beautiful and warm down there. And they've found that they've had, although I should say, I think they still get a lot more access to a lot more records than we do, but they've had the problem with governors and their staff using personal email accounts for communication and trying to get around public access that way. There's been other issues. I mean, there's so many exemptions, and there's different ways. You could have a communication go through an attorney, and then they could claim attorney-client privilege. So sure, you know, you do want the law to be something that is the way it ought to be, but we do hear from other states that have better FOIA laws still run into problems where there's always another way that someone could try to get around it.
Is anyone trying to change this and tighten these loopholes, if you will, in Michigan?
Yes, there's a number of bills that have been before the legislature, and some come session after session, and by both Democratic and Republican lawmakers. Brandon Dillon, a state representative from Grand Rapids, has a bill to include the legislature. He wants to include lawmakers, and he said that he'd also like to include the governor, but he thought that was a good first step for lawmakers to at least include themselves when they expect county commissioners and others to be covered under a public records law. He said the first step to reforming the law is to cover ourselves. There's a Republican, Tom McMillan, who's tried to bring in a number of improvements to the law, including putting some restrictions on the fees that can be charged. And he said he would also favor both lawmakers and the governor being covered. But these bills don't seem to get a lot of traction. And you know, and part of the reason is, even though, you know, we featured in this story a gentleman who lives near the bridge, who's been trying to get some information about the land acquisition that affects him and affects his home. Maybe the impression is that it's just journalists that use the Freedom of Information Act. It's not, you know, and maybe a lot of citizens don't, but it's the kind of thing when you do need information and you want to be able to get it, that's when you turn to that law. But there probably hasn't been a lot of public pressure on the legislature to make these changes.
Paul Egan's piece on Michigan's Freedom of Information Act can be found on thefreep.com. Paul Egan, Detroit Free Press, Lansing Bureau. Always good to talk with you. Thank you.
You too, Cindy. Thanks.
We've been hearing this. The music industry is changing. Stateside's Emily Fox reports on how one Michigan band is challenging the music industry with silence.
This is Wolfpack. Wolfpack got its start at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. They're in the middle of a cross-country tour. They aren't charging admission. They aren't paying out of pocket. Their tour is completely funded from an album they put up on the online music streaming service Spotify, an album that was completely silent.
Here's how it works. Wolfpack released Sleepify, the album, last week on Spotify. This album's different than our previous albums. This album's much quieter. In fact, we believe it's the most silent album ever recorded.
That's Jack Stratton. He plays keyboard and drums for Wolfpack. That was his pitch on YouTube after the band released their so-called Sleepify album in March. And some argue that silence is art. American composer John Cage certainly thought so. That's the guy who performed the song 433 back in the 50s. It was basically him going on stage, sitting in complete silence for 4 minutes and 33 seconds and calling it music. Well, even if you don't believe that silence is music, it sure can be used as a tool. There is an economic reason Wolfpack released their silent album. Here's how Stratton explains it in the YouTube pitch.
When you listen to a Wolfpack song on Spotify, Spotify pays us a half a cent. So if you were to listen to Sleepify all night on repeat, you'd generate $4.
So $4 a night of sleep might not sound like a lot, but Wolfpack got a lot of people to do it. Their promise was if they generated enough money in royalties, they would put on free shows to the cities where their Sleepify album was streamed the most. After about a month of fans streaming the album on Spotify, Wolfpack ended up making $20,000 in royalties. But Wolfpack didn't get away with their Sleepify album without a fight. Stratton says Spotify said Wolfpack's silent album violated their terms of use.
Yeah, I was in touch with one of their spokesperson, and it was just a kind of back and forth ending in them just kind of taking it down. I woke up and it was gone.
But even though Spotify removed the album, Wolfpack still ended up getting the full $20,000 in royalties. They're now delivering on their promise to fans who stream their albums and are putting on free shows in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Ann Arbor. Theo Katzman plays guitar and drums for Wolfpack. He says what the band did with Sleepify is a wake-up call for the music industry.
I guess the moral of the story and why the Sleepify thing is so sweet is that the major labels are hoping to find a way to monetize music streaming as the next great wave of making it say, like, listen, maybe perhaps the indie thing is kind of over, but the majors are back and it's profitable again. And so to have Wolfpack kind of pull the rug out at the outset and be like, well, wait a minute, look what we just did, is a pretty funny thing in a hopefully a lighthearted way.
Wolfpack will be performing at the Blind Pig tomorrow night in Ann Arbor for their Sleepify tour. They'll be playing tracks off of their newly released album, Fugue State, which, by the way, was funded by fans through the online crowdfunding site Kickstarter. With Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This month marks the 201st anniversary of one of the most famous and pivotal naval battles in U.S. history, the Battle of Lake Erie. Oliver Hazard Perry defeated the British and secured Lake Erie for the United States, and his famous report summed up the battle very neatly, quote, "We have met the enemy, and they are ours. Two ships, two brigs, one schooner, and one sloop." But what about today? Just who owns the Great Lakes? Mark Burrows is the acting director with the Great Lakes Regional Office of the International Joint Commission. Good to have you with us, Mark.
Oh, great to be here, Cindy.
So here we are 201 years later after Oliver Perry met the enemy and they were his on Lake Erie. Who does get to own a body of water as big as any of the Great Lakes?
You know, it's a complicated question. There's been over 20 different treaties and meetings or agreements, I guess you would call them, between Canada and the United States since like 1783 and going on all the way up to like 1925 to try to sort out the boundaries between the two countries. And at first they just used names of rivers and landmarks without really accurately defining exactly where they've been. And then over the years it's gotten much more precise and marked. And it's very interesting to see. In general, the states and the provinces own the bottom land now. So that area where the battle took place is owned by Ohio. And, you know, the Perry Monument over in Put-in Bay is in Ohio waters. And Ontario owns the northern part of the lake and Pelee Island and that. It's very accurately defined right now.
So you say the bottom land. Does that mean no one owns the actual water?
The bottom land is a term that they use to describe who owns, you know, the property out to the international border. And the coastal area, they actually define from the high water mark in a lot of states, but all the states have jurisdiction over land between the high water mark and then out to the international border. And one interesting thing about the Great Lakes is that it's considered to be internal waters for both Canada and the United States, so there's no such thing as international waters or anything like you have out in the ocean when you get past the territorial sea. That's at the 12-mile mark, and then you have the 200-mile coastal management zone where the countries have some jurisdiction over the natural resources and everything that you can take from the bottom of the ocean. beyond that, you have, you know, some rights of innocent passage and rights in international waters. Well, you don't have that in the Great Lakes. So it's either you're in the U.S. or Canada or in state or provincial waters. So, you know, it's a lot of people don't realize that since the lakes are so huge, they think that they're just this inland ocean or sea that you would have the same sorts of navigation rights that you do out in the salt water.
Now, we all know fresh water is really one of the greatest resources in the world. And we also know that states, for example, in the Southwest are casting covetous eyes toward the water in the Great Lakes. How much thought do you give to the possibility that the Great Lakes and its fresh water will become like oil in the years to come?
Well, you know, there's an interesting book that was written about the water wars and the idea that, you know, water would be the next natural resource that people would be fighting over and that. And I think you can thank the governments of Canada and the United States and the provinces of Quebec and Ontario and all the Great Lakes states for having this Great Lakes Compact that requires that no water withdrawals above a certain limit can be done without the concurrence of all the governors and ministers in the lakes. So basically, any one of them could veto a major withdrawal, and I don't think you'll ever see water being shipped off down to, you know, someplace in the Southwest or anything in mass quantities like people feared would happen back in the late 90s. I think it was around 96 there was some proposal where I think a shipping company was going to fill up a tanker full of Great Lakes water for export, and that kind of started a public controversy, and that proposal got shot down. And then over the years, the conversation kept going, and they came up with this Great Lakes Water Compact, which is a great protection, I think, for those of us that live in the Great Lakes Basin, so that we know we'll be here to enjoy this great natural resource, and we won't have to worry about it getting shipped off someplace.
Sounds like you feel that the kind of this compact and the laws we have today should keep pace with the demand and keep the peace in the future?
I think so. They've got some real common sense type protections there where if you have a community that's on the border of the Great Lakes drainage basin and they want to draw their water from the Great Lakes, there's provisions for that to be done if, as long as they return the water, the treated water, back to the lake. So that sort of thought went into all this process where if you're going to use the water, you have to return the treated water back to the lakes. And I think a lot of good common sense went into it. They do allow some withdrawals for things like bottling and canning and that sort of thing where it's used for industrial uses, and they have some limits on the sizes of containers and that sort of thing. I think that's going to serve the whole Great Lakes Basin very well over the coming years.
Mark Burrows is Acting Director of the Great Lakes Regional Office of the International Joint Commission. Mark, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Well, you're welcome, Cindy. It's been great talking to you.
As always, an invitation to let us know what is on your mind. What stories are you focusing on or issues that you really want to hear more about? Just let us know, and it's easy. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Drive across the country and flip through the dial of your radio. And chances are you'll find that station. The one playing Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin, The Who, The Rolling Stones, the classic rock radio station. Well, did you know that classic rock format was born in Michigan nearly 30 years ago? Oakland County-based radio consultant Fred Jacobs was part of that birth, and he is with us now. Fred, tell us what was happening in radio in 1985 that kind of got you thinking about this whole idea of this classic rock format?
Well, a big part of it, Cindy, was the whole MTV phenomenon, and everything was all about what was new right now at that moment, and to a great degree, that older legacy, heritage, nostalgia music was pretty much being ignored on the radio, and so I just connected some dots. I always have done a lot of audience research, and the more listeners you talk to, it was true back then, it's true today, they can really tell you the story if you actually sit down and listen to them. And so we kept hearing that there were all these concerns that older music that people had grown up with really weren't being played all that much on the radio, and so it was really just a matter of kind of going into the library and figuring it out.
Well, then, as you were developing this format, give us kind of a quintessential sampling of the kind of artists and songs that you saw as being perfect classic rock.
Well, the whole thing really comes down to the golden age of rock, and when it finally dawned on me that it wasn't just about nostalgia, but that the period of rock, really starting from the Beatles and at that time going out into the late 70s, wasn't just a period of time, but was music that mattered, was the music that people would be listening to 100 years from now. I mean, that was really a big part of it. And then I started seeing some kind of pop culture validation. The Big Chill came out around that time, and if you remember that soundtrack, right, I mean, it was the Stones, Motown was throughout there as well, and it just kind of reinforced to me just how powerful the music really was in people's lives. And so that was a real big part of it, was just understanding how much the music really meant to people back then. And then, you know, serendipity is always part of it, a little bit of luck. The development of the compact disc was really timely, too, because that was a moment in time where people looked at their old scratchy record libraries and said, wow, here's a really cool chance to upgrade and have this great digital format that obviously had some storage advantages as well, but just sounded great. So as people were really updating their music libraries, classic rock really kind of came around at exactly that time.
And this was different than oldies. When I think of oldies, I think of Jan and Dean or you know, late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, and a big difference is that really all of the artists involved in the format, again, with a few exceptions like Jimi Hendrix and the Doors, were still very much viable when classic rock happened. McCartney was still out there and still is today.
Yeah.
The Stones were still touring. The Who were absolutely viable. So it really wasn't what I call a rearview mirror kind of format. Classic rock really sort of had a contemporary feel, even though it showcased older music. But yeah, it was kind of a next generation oldies to a great degree, yes.
I'm speaking with radio consultant Fred Jacobs, the Oakland County-based consultant who created the classic rock radio format right here in Michigan nearly 30 years ago. And this really wasn't all about top hits, was it, Fred? This was, what, getting into the deeper tracks of these albums?
Yeah, that is really where the art of the format really comes into play, because there's really a base of maybe 400 or 500 songs that everybody agrees on are just absolute stone-cold classic rock hits. But when you begin to start moving into the albums, that's where there's a bit of divergence of opinion. And what I really learned along the road is that, to a great degree, the albums that were being played in your dormitory room are the ones that you really know extremely well. It's just that the commonality of experience is not always there for everybody. So for some people, Thick as a Brick is one of those albums, and for other people, it's Abbey Road. And so that really is the art of kind of balancing the familiar with the depth, which is really, I think, what separates the great classic rock programmers from the also-rans.
What were the earliest stations to flip to classic rock?
The very first one that really mattered was right here in Michigan, and that was WMMQ, which we like to say was in Lansing, but in reality was in Charlotte.
All right.
And it had a signal problem, and it really needed a format that could cut through. And so MMQ was really the first, and it exploded. And then from there, as you know, Cindy, radio is, especially commercial radio, is kind of a lemming business. Once it right? Once it works somewhere, then everybody jumps on the bandwagon. And so in fairly short order, we had classic rock stations on the air in Kansas City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Cleveland came on board, CSX Detroit, which is still, of course, a classic rock station,
yes,
and doing very well, was one of the earlier ones, too. It really took off, and today there are more classic rock stations and classic hit stations in America than there are mainstream rock stations and alternative stations by actually quite a bit.
Why do you think that is, Fred? Why is classic rock still going strong some 30 years later? Is it because there's so many of us baby boomers who still want to hear Won't Get Fooled Again?
That's exactly right. I mean, you never get tired of hearing the music that you grew up with. And then the other piece of it is that the classic rock demographic at the time was right in the advertising agency sweet spot. It was the audience that everybody wanted. Now, that audience is getting a little bit long in the tooth right now, and that's a big controversy in the classic rock radio conversation. But what has happened is that, to a great degree, younger people have discovered this music too, which is really a bizarre phenomenon, because for your listeners who grew up in the 60s and 70s, it was really unthinkable to be enjoying the music that your parents loved back in, say, the 30s or the 40s. But classic rock has really proved to be an anomaly, and there are just so many young people in their teens and their 20s who know this music extremely well. So it's very interesting that there actually is sort of a whole new younger demographic enjoying classic rock for the first time.
What do you think will be the next new radio format? Any idea?
if I knew that one, right? It is so hard to predict the taste. I do think that one of the lessons that I learned from classic rock is that every generation has its own nostalgia. And even though it might be hard to believe that hip-hop of say, the late 80s and the 90s could possibly fall into that category, the fact is it already has. So to a great degree, there may be a huge resurgence for 90s radio. It's just an incredible thing. But again, that music that you grew up with, that when you first started dating was playing in the background, I mean, just all of those memories that you have as a teen, that stuff is really near and dear to you. And that's what formats are made of.
Have you taken the classic rock focus on the 60s and the 70s and moved it through the years? Has it broadened now? Are we talking 80s into the early 90s?
Yes, there's definitely been some updating. And when classic rock first started happening, we were looking at U2 and wondering, wow, could that ever fit on a classic rock station? Today, the 80s are very much a part of it, but the 60s are hanging in there extremely well, too. So the format is actually diversified more over time. So it actually is a broader footprint now as a format than it was when we first got things going back in the 80s.
And it is a funny moment for someone. I saw a comment on Facebook the other day, and I don't remember the artist, but it was somebody from the 90s, and it was like, really? So-and-so is classic rock? And it reminds them all the years march on, don't they?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of comments, especially about Nirvana, which is very likely who that comment was about, because when people realize that Nirvana broke more than 20 years ago, it's just a reminder of something that we all know. I mean, tempus fugit, right? I mean, time just flies. And it's just hard to imagine that grunge music from Seattle is well more than 20 years old. It is classic rock for a different generation.
Fred Jacobs, Michigan-based radio consultant with Jacobs Media, the creator of the classic rock radio format. Pleasure to talk with you, and thank you so much, Fred.
Thanks, Cindy. Enjoyed it.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the campaign season builds, you can count on Governor Rick Snyder and his supporters to trumpet a variety of business climate rankings that show Michigan climbing up there. But what do all those business climate rankings actually mean? MLive's Rick Hagland is with us. Rick, you point out in your story these improved rankings seem to point to good things for the state, and certainly the governor will make that case that a strong ranking as a pro-business state is good for the state, is it?
Well, they do, particularly if you're a business person. We've had a lot of changes in the tax climate in Michigan, making the tax climate more hospitable for businesses, particularly small businesses, most of whom don't pay anything under the new corporate income tax. Some other changes, such as the right to work law, changes in unemployment taxation that employers pay, all make it theoretically a better place for businesses to do business in the state of Michigan.
And certainly Rick Snyder, right from the time he stepped up as a possible candidate for governor, kept making the case that being a pro-business state is good for Michigan, is it?
Well, not necessarily. It can be. But what's good for business isn't always good for the general economy. And in the column, I point to a study that was done by an economist, Peter Fisher, out of Iowa, done for an organization called Good Jobs First, that basically looked at six major business climate rankings. And it found, these rankings didn't necessarily translate into great economies. Some of them conflicted with each other in terms of the rankings.
In fact, I think your column quotes him as saying that these business climate studies are, in his words, worse than meaningless.
That's what he said. That's right. One of the things you look at is some states that rank, very low in business climate actually have pretty good economies. You look at Minnesota, which we've talked about before, is a pretty good example. I mean, it ranks 47th in the Tax Foundation's business climate ranking, which gets a lot of attention, but yet it's got one of the best economies in the country in terms of employment, in terms of income of the residents. These rankings also don't take into consideration, other factors in terms of road infrastructure, which we're all talking about, quality schools, to some degree labor costs. So they leave out a lot of things in terms of what makes for a strong state economy.
What then should we really be paying closest attention to, Rick, as we, as voters, try to gauge the extent of Michigan's recovery?
I think you have to take these rankings as really a grain of salt. They're fun to read, and it's like everybody seems to do that. There's always a top 10 state for this, a top 10 state for that. But I think basically what you need to look at is how is the state doing in terms of producing jobs, producing good jobs with income? What are the poverty rates in the state? Which direction is that heading? How are our residents doing in terms of educational attainment? Because, having at least some college, a 2 or 4 year degree is really important in terms of being able to get a good job, and having a fairly high percentage of your state with a college education is an important factor in recruiting businesses and employers to the state.
So hearing these business ranking studies saying, well, look, according to the American Economic Development Institute, Michigan's the most improved state in its top 10 pro-business states report. Is all of that really more about politics and ability to say, hey, look, we are the comeback state?
Yeah, there's a fair amount of politics involved in that. Essentially what they're saying is that, hey, if you're a business, you want to go to a place that has lower taxes and pays workers less, has right to work laws, doesn't pay a lot of unemployment benefits, here's a state that you can go to. Another fallacy with these things is that there's a couple of states, Wyoming and South Dakota, that tend to rank pretty high perpetually in these business climate rankings, which sort of begs the question, if they're such great places for business, why aren't businesses flocking there? There is not a single Fortune 500 company headquartered in the states of Wyoming or South Dakota. So I think even businesses maybe look a little bit askance at these rankings.
MLive writer Rick Hagland taking a critical look at those business climate rankings that we hear trumpeted so much. But Rick, just to be clear, we aren't saying it is a bad thing to have business want to come and set up shop in your state, are we?
That's right. A business climate is important in the sense of if you're really out of whack with your neighbors, I mean, if Michigan, for instance, had double the corporate income tax rate and extremely burdensome regulations compared to Indiana and Ohio, that really does put us at a competitive disadvantage.
MLive writer Rick Hagelin taking a critical look at the business climate rankings. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Rick.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Taxes, one of the two great inevitables in life. Whether business, income, or sales, tax dollars drive the state and its politics. Bridge Magazine contributor Ted Roloffs is looking at what he calls who wants what in the long war over taxes. Good to have you back, Ted.
Yeah, good to be with you.
And also welcome back to Michigan State Economics Professor Charlie Ballard. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Cindy. How are you doing?
Very good. Good to have you both here to talk taxes. Ted, what are you and Bridge truth squatting in this piece, Michigan Tax Facts, Who Wants What in the Long War Over Taxes?
Well, we're taking kind of a big picture look at how are we taxed, how much are we taxed, and then asking people from different perspectives, are we paying too much in taxes? Are we paying too little? What would happen if we cut taxes? Where do we stand as a state? And what overall philosophy and approach is best going forward?
Now, your piece starts by observing that Lansing's going to spend more than $52 billion this year, including both state and federal funds. And then you ask the question, is that the right amount? Can there ever be an answer to that question, Ted?
There are a lot of answers to that question, and it's familiar on the state level. It's familiar on the national level. It's really a debate that never goes away. How are we taxed? Should we be paying more? Should we be paying less? And I think part of that conversation, what we're looking at in some of these pieces for Bridge Magazine, is where do we stand as a state in terms of quality of life? Ultimately, taxes pay for a great number of things that we consider to be part of a quality life, including schools, roads, obviously corrections, social services. From the state level to the local governments, what is known as revenue sharing, which helps cities do what they do, and we also look at overall quality of life in the state as measured by spending on higher education, K-12 education, and one that I think everyone's familiar with, the state of our roads.
And Charlie Ballard, has there ever been a time in Michigan's history when there could be a pretty good consensus of agreement with is it the right amount or how much is enough?
I think it's been more contentious in recent decades than perhaps it was back in the 70s, but this is always going to be something over which people argue. There are fundamentally different views about what taxes we should have, and especially about who should pay those taxes. An awful lot of folks would like somebody else to pay taxes, but don't want to pay taxes themselves. And so if everybody says, well, okay, it's fine to have taxes, just don't tax me, that creates a real problem in the politics. An awful lot of the debate, if you scratch under the surface, really it's a debate about how progressive should the tax system be.
What do you mean by that?
A progressive tax is one that takes a larger percentage of the income from high-income people than low-income people. For instance, the federal individual income tax has graduated rates, higher tax rates on those at the top of the income scale. Michigan is one of only a handful of states that has a flat rate income tax, where the marginal rate is 4.25% on every dollar of taxable income. So in a lot of ways, Michigan's tax system is less progressive. Much of the argument is over how progressive it should be. For instance, there are various groups, and I've said myself, I would prefer Michigan have a graduated income tax. That means that relatively high-income people, like actually myself, would pay more, and those at the bottom of the income scale would pay less. That's something that tends to be favored by liberals or progressives and tends to be opposed by conservatives because of a fundamentally different degree of comfort with income inequality.
Well, in fact, Ted Roloffs, in seeking that answer to who wants what in the long war of taxes, you got right to the heart of what Charlie was talking about. You spoke with Michael Lefebvre of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy and to John Austin of the Michigan Economic Center at the Prima Civitas Foundation. So give us that sense of the perfect world tax-wise, according to Michael Lefebvre, would be
less. We can always cut taxes. And I think your classic argument from that perspective is cut taxes, create economic growth, better for everyone. That's just a very familiar argument. Let's lower the cost of doing business. That'll create economic growth. Then government won't have to spend as much. that's one perspective. You look at it from the other side, John Austin, and he looks at the point of view that, boy, we should be paying a lot more. If you look at where we are today relative to where we were three decades ago, we're paying less as a share of overall personal income and taxes in the state of Michigan. And he would point to, we're paying less for K-12 schools over the past decade, far less for higher education. We're paying relatively less to maintain our roads. We've cut revenue sharing to cities by something like $6 billion over the last 12 years, and that can all be measured in the quality of life that we see around us. You can make another argument that it's more difficult to attract and retain the kind of talented workforce that you want if people are living in cities that are degraded. They want more than that, than just a job, any place, not in a crumbling city. So that's an argument on the other side. One thing I would mention, you know, we take a look at the difficulty that a lot of politicians have in actually spitting out the word tax. It's very hard for politicians to be upfront about that. If you did a poll, 100 out of 100 people in Michigan would agree that we need to fix our roads. And yet, very few politicians are willing to really step to the plate and say, here's how we're going to pay for it. Because somewhere along the line, the money has to come from somewhere. So maybe we put up with roads that get a little worse every year, or at some point we find a way to bite the bullet and come to an agreement. Here's where the money has to come from, because you can't fix roads for free.
Charlie Ballard, the governor and his supporters, folks like Michael Lefebvre at the Mackinac Center, say this business tax cut gave jobs a boost, and Michigan's corporate tax climate is now up to number 9 in the nation, according to the Tax Foundation. Others will argue that. But what does the data really show? Is there empirical evidence to back up those claims?
There is some evidence. I would never say that taxes make no difference. And I was on record long before Governor Snyder started his campaign. I was on record as saying that the Michigan business tax had some very fundamental flaws and that we should get rid of it. On the other hand, I said that we should fully replace the revenue, which was not done, and I would have differed with the way in which we actually replaced some of that revenue. Nevertheless, the Michigan business tax had lots of problems. But that doesn't mean that if we reform that there will be a sudden and huge increase in economic activity. Lots of studies have been done in terms of the effects of taxes on the location of economic activity. And all else equal, and that's really important, all else equal, lower taxes have a modest positive effect on attracting jobs and so on. But all else isn't equal. Because the number one thing that employers want and need is a highly skilled workforce. If you don't have skilled workers, it doesn't matter what your taxes are, you do not have a viable business. And so higher taxes are often associated with a stronger economy if those taxes are used wisely, especially for education and for transportation infrastructure. And so taxes are about fourth or fifth on the list of things that are important. And many folks act as if cutting taxes is the solution to all problems. And I disagree with that strongly. Taxes are, after all, what we pay for civilized society. I'd also mention, you cut taxes and you have crappy roads. Well, that doesn't mean that there's no cost. A couple months ago, I paid what I call the pothole tax. I had to have both front rims replaced and the rear sway bar. And it cost me a lot of money. It's not as if it was costless to let our roads deteriorate. Somebody is going to pay, and I would much rather pay taxes to fix the roads than have low taxes and then have my car messed up.
One thing I'd like to point out, Charles, at this point, that it is a growth industry for our repair shops around Michigan, so we can't forget the economic multiplier there.
Yeah, we've all forked over money.
We're all supporting the auto repair shops and chiropractors.
And the tire shops. We did our bit there, too. And on that subject of tax cuts, and you point out in your piece, Ted, we've talked about it here on Stateside about the fact, for example, Minnesota has higher taxes than Michigan, but it has a higher per capita income. It has lower unemployment than Michigan, and there's concern that this push to cut taxes in Michigan is a ticket to mediocrity.
To truly isolate taxation among all the other factors that lead to economic growth, and you can look at Minnesota, and they pay a lot more in taxes, and their per capita income is considerably higher than Michigan. The unemployment rate is well below Michigan's. total cause and effect, I don't think you can make that case. But it's certainly worth considering in this overall discussion. And one thing I did want to bring up is I think it's important in the political context of, you know, how it's so difficult to really have an honest discussion about taxes in Michigan. 1983, in a great deal of economic difficulty, the state passed an income tax increase. As a result, two Democratic state senators were recalled over that. And at that point, the control of the state Senate flipped from Democratic to Republican. That's 30 years ago. It's been Republican ever since. So that might explain a little bit why we don't often get true, frank, open, and honest discussions about taxes from politicians, because it's risky business if you want to stay in office.
And looking forward, it's pretty hard to believe this is a debate that's going to be settled or ending anytime soon.
It will never end. And, you know, a lot of times what happens is maybe something gets done in a lame duck session where politicians are exiting office and they can have a moment of candid reflection and action.
Last thoughts, Charlie?
It is sort of a shame that the current political atmosphere is such that many important issues can only be addressed in the lame duck session after the election.
Well, Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard and Bridge Magazine contributing writer Ted Roloffs, as always, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Yeah, glad to do it.
Ted's piece is part of a 10-part special report exploring Michigan taxing and spending issues, and you can find it online at bridgemi.com. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.